This is Tripwire with a special guest podcast for the week ending November 12th, Navigating Challenges in Commercial Real Estate. I'm Martha Kocher with Trep, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, Commercial Real Estate and CLO Markets. I'm with Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Joe McBride, Head of CRE Finance. And joining us today is Douglas Wilson. Douglas Wilson Companies offers business workouts, receiverships, and fiduciary services. Doug, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Give us a quick overview of your background and what your firm does.
Thank you. My roots really are in large urban infill mixed-use development. I'm just not a paid consultant receiver. The journey really goes back to me being from Chicago, going to school in Colorado and staying there during the boom times of the 70s, and then leaving there in the early 80s when they were on the start of an energy collapse. I moved then to San Diego at age 34. I was fortunate. I had a mentor partner, 13 years older, that liked big deals. And we moved here, and San Diego was on the leading edge of some significant growth. And we bought a block downtown. The centerpiece of that block was an elegant old Fox Theater built in 1929. We had entitlements to build 1.2 million feet of office, hospitality, some retail, and a large parking structure. What made that project intriguing is we learned the symphony was looking for a new home. So we actually charitably conveyed that elegant old theater to the symphony and built this 1.2 million square foot project around it. Our timing actually was very good. We were able to pre-lease after the office building. I was only 34 to 39, so I often say I was too young to know abject fear. But two things I observed. One, I got about three PhDs in development process. Secondarily, I also observed on a parallel time during the 80s in Colorado that I left, they were literally in an economic collapse, as was Texas and all of the West, due to the energy collapse. So I observed the unpredictability and the impact on commercial real estate of economic cycles. All these people that were my buddies back in Colorado that I thought were young and rich and affluent, successful, they literally were in a market that they were breathing. They often said it was through a snorkel. So I learned in 1989, when I sold Symphony Towers to a pension fund and went on my own, that I wanted to do something that most real estate developers didn't know. And that was, how do you navigate difficult times? What is the strategy to get through down markets? I sensed there was one coming in California and the country, and I had a lawyer explain a remedy under a deed of trust for a commercial lender to put something in called a receiver, an agent of the court, to look after a broken project or a project that was in default. I did my own due diligence and quickly determined that it was really a localized mom and pop, not very sophisticated business. And I built a strategy to build much more of an institutional platform, one that would be, although based in Southern California, would have a national footprint, would handle all asset classes, build relationships with banks, pension funds, life companies, special servicers. And now I look back only 31 years later and have found we've done about 1,000 of those assignments in 35 states for about $15 billion of assets. So learned a lot of lessons. I also went back and have always maintained a private sector development business and have built about $1 billion of projects, you know, in and around San Diego. So we have today a very diversified real estate platform that is really built to be able to navigate successfully all cycles, because most of them are unpredictable. You don't know.
Doug, thanks. That's great. Thanks for the background. So for those of our listeners out there who may not be as in the weeds as we are or as you are, can you just give us a quick idea of kind of what it means to be a receiver? Like, who do you deal with? What role do you serve in the CRE space?
Simply stated, a receiver is always an individual. They're not a company or a corporation. And the receiver is an agent of the court. It can either be a state court or a federal court. But a receiver is someone that is, although oftentimes a lender will petition the court, that receiver actually is working for the judge and has a fiduciary duty to all the parties. And so the authorities stem from the court, and the possibilities of a receiver and the role you play are really very, very broad and depend upon the challenges or the opportunities of a particular fact pattern or the assets. It's a very powerful tool. you know, oftentimes a lender, they don't want to take possession of a property in a foreclosure. They may want to put a receiver in, so they're insulated from title. So a receiver could deal with things as varied as environmental issues, completing construction, having access to various documents, financial information, with the real mandate in the goal, fundamental, is to preserve value for the parties, and to enhance value, either through lease up, completing construction, and the like. And so the process we can get into a little bit later, but again, typically a lender, and that could be a bank, a pension fund, a life company, a special servicer, it could also be a partnership dispute, may have an asset that they no longer have confidence in their borrower. That borrower may be in default, it may be out of capital. And so the lender then looks at his options, the remedies, and they have an opportunity to put a receiver in. And the scope of that receivership can be broad, can be huge. It really depends upon what the fact pattern is with the asset. And all of that scope is really put into what's called the initial receivership order, which is a strategic document that we work on very carefully with the parties to make sure that we have the authorities to perform the work. And so there are really four types of receiverships. One is called a rents and profits receivership. That's the one people are most used to. You're put in place and you know take over the operation of a building, preserve value, collect the rents, maintain entitlements, complete construction, do a litany of things. Then you can have an equity receivership. That receiver is where an individual would actually be put in to take over a business, actually take over the entity. And that entity can have, obviously, real estate assets affiliated with it. We've had many of those assignments through the years. Then you can have what's called a post-judgment receivership. We have one currently where there was judgment entered to actually fix an easement on a coastal piece of property in California. And so in that case, the receiver is put in again under a court order to actually implement that post-judgment remedy. The final one that really isn't applicable here, but I think you'd find of interest, is where you have a federal remedy, where there's an SEC matter, an FTC matter that involves Ponzi schemes and frauds and forensic accounting. So you can imagine there is a lot of war stories that we have.
So Doug, we have a lot of questions we want to get to you over the course of this interview, but your comments before about being brought in from time to time by a special servicer or working with a special servicer, it led me to think of this, and that is, how often does the alignment get unaligned? You start out with a document which says, you know, here's the strategy we have, but over time, either you or the special servicer start to think what originally made sense, given market conditions, has changed. We need to go back to the drawing board.
Well, that's a very astute and insightful question. And again, it's fundamental to a receivership. Contrary to what a lot of lenders think, a receiver does not just, quote, a pawn of the lender. It is important. In fact, it's not important. It's imperative. The receiver maintains neutrality. So the initial order that we talked about earlier that gives us the entire authorities and scope of the work, normally that is the playbook. That's what we want to follow. But if in fact the receiver is not working directly for the lender, the receiver has a duty to be, you know, fair to all the parties, but typically follows that playbook. But if there is a deviation, and that oftentimes can deviate someone from what the lender's expectations are, that can lead to a slight conflict. We've always been able to meander that just through being collaborative and how we approach projects. But the one real pitfall to be cognizant of is a receiver never wants to have a disgruntled borrower. Say the receiver is, quote, a pawn of the lender. The receiver is just working as a tool of the bank or the special servicer, because then they put themselves at risk for acting for a lawsuit for lender in possession. So, you know, a astute receiver will maintain that neutrality, but hopefully avoid some of those conflicts you're talking about by being open, communicative, collaborative. And if there are changes to the business plan, you know, address them up front.
Yeah, I guess part of the thing that got me to think about that question was where we were looking at things at the beginning of COVID, especially for things like hotels and retail, and where it looked a year later once the vaccine came out were vastly, vastly different. So maybe we'll get back into that. a little bit later. Turning to something that is kind of front and center with our interests here at TREP, and we've talked about it a lot in the podcast, we often say that no two crises are the same, right? The 1990 to 94 was a lot different than the great financial crisis. COVID was a lot different from the great financial crisis. Tell us, you know, what you're seeing now and how that compares to previous downturns that you've been through.
There are serious distinctions. And you mentioned going back into the early 90s, that was really the RTC crisis. And that was the foundation of my firm. At that point, all assets were marked to market, a term that's not often used today. It was just a firestorm of activity where there was a fire sale of all assets. And the government was really forcing that methodology for a resolution of these assets. Fast forward to, you know, the Great Recession of some years ago, that was also remarkably powerful and unpredictable, but the fact patterns were different. We had at that point, you know, we had the housing crisis that stimulated it, and then we had systemic issues like Lehman, who had been a partner of mine, by the way, in the real estate deal. So I live that, but you had the systemic shock to the system. But the government did not step in and say they've got to mark all assets to market at that point. Although everything was on the rocks, all asset classes were challenged, there was lack of liquidity, everyone's running for the exits, they still were able to have a resolution over many years moving forward. And the government helped to facilitate that with low rates, that type of thing. But a lot of lessons that were learned. We also had different loan structures. A lot of them, then we had large syndicated loans. You'd have big loans, Credit Suisse was in this space, many of the other banks, so they'd be the lead lender. And I was a receiver on a number of these, including the Tamarack Resort in Idaho, $240 million loan with about six different participants. Some were private equity firms, some were regulated banks. So you can imagine the challenges when that asset turned into a workout. So today, where are we today? Very different indeed. We have had a cycle that's been long in the tooth, even pre-COVID. And so COVID happens and everybody presses the pause button. None of us knew, but then it became the era of forbearance that we've all talked about till we're blue in the face. And so all of these sins that may have existed at the property level and for the appropriate reasons, political, from a business standpoint and the like, there wasn't just everyone enforcing all their remedies. Time was granted to everyone so that we could navigate our through really uncharted waters. And so now, in that really that, you know, the issues that have arisen have too largely been de minimis relative to the last cycle at this point because of a combination of forbearance, low interest rates, and the like, you know, these things have not percolated to the surface. That is not to say, however, that there are not challenges, that we see clouds in the horizon, lessons that should be learned from the past that I think is important to be looking for today, which we can talk about.
Doug, I guess kind of a quick offshoot question. In turn, you know, we speak so often here about CMBS, right? We talk a lot about special servicers and what they're up to and how they're resolving loans that are properties that are in trouble. Obviously, forbearance was a big thing, like you mentioned, but I guess just broadly, when dealing with different types of, I'd say, lenders or players, do you find that there are different strategies or different kind of, I don't know, mandates? You know, if you're dealing with a bank versus, you know, a private equity fund versus a special servicer in CMBS?
Clearly, the mandates are, it's across the spectrum. I mean, what we find today is the large money center banks, because of the regulatory changes after the Great Recession, they're not sitting on a lot of troubled assets. They were really only lending you money if you didn't really need it. So the banks that were lending were the regional banks, and we're seeing some issues there. But how they deal with their remedies is very different than a CMBS lender through special servicer. You know, in this last year and a half, 2 years, we, through TREP, monitored all of these servicers and all of their assets, thinking hospitality would be, you know, a floodgate. And all of these defaults were existing, but they were forbearance. So that did not happen. What we are finding, that's a bit of a curious anomaly, and we've witnessed this over the last 18 months, is that, you know, as we all know, to fill the economic lending void, private equity once again reared its head and came in either through equity, various forms of equity, prep for other forms, but also debt, initially as bridge debt. Then they evolved into more sophisticated construction loans. But this is all typically shorter term loans. This isn't in any way permanent financing. So we have seen everybody, I mean, literally there are, as we all know, numerous of these funds, and they've aggressively stepped in this place with a voluminous amount of capital. Now, what we have observed, and we have a real life example of, we've been named receiver on a number of these loans with these debt funds. And they've been on various asset classes, some partially built construction, some pieces of land that the developer acquisition development loans that they couldn't move forward with. And so there's the whole spectrum. But obviously they're unregulated. And how they deal with these issues moving forward is a bit unknown. But we are seeing some challenges more in that sector today.
You know, when you talk about forbearances before, you know, I think that in the beginning of the pandemic, you know, maybe the terms I would use were patience and mercy. When right. things began, nobody was eager to play the bad cop early on. You know, they knew what was going on was unprecedented. And, you know, I think from where we sat, the forbearances were fairly quick and somewhat generous. Now that we're 18 months into this and the economy has started to heal, are you seeing the end of that mercy and patience? Are the people that you're representing on the lender side playing a little bit more brass tacks now than they might have been, you know, June 2020 or September 2020?
I think we are seeing that evidenced. I don't want to name any particular players, but there are a couple of servicers that are absolutely doing that. They're perfecting their remedies a little more aggressively. You know, we know the world of CMBS is highly structured debt, and there are a litany of footfalls that can occur to make sure covenants are maintained and the like. And we have a couple of situations right now in office buildings, hospitality, where they are beginning to enforce their remedies a little more. What we are finding, however, is a broad brush statement that we all know is because of the massive amount of liquidity in the market, the amount of money that's looking for a home at rates that are unprecedented for this period of time. You know, we're seeing, you know, liquidity rush to be the savior of some situations. We've had one that is a story that I never thought I would have told in my career. There's a massive loan of about $150 million secured by over a dozen properties in Southern California. I was put in as receiver late last year when that loan matured. We were in place for about 6 months. Lender number two then came in, and they were able to pay off that loan at par, no discount, at par, and brought that loan with really a loan-to-own strategy. But at that point, the loan's subject to me being the receiver, because I'm part of the court action, at par. 6 weeks later, the borrower brings in lender number three that pays off lender number two at not just par, but with a multi-million dollar prepayment penalty. Now, that is something that speaks to the underlying marketplace, to the volumes of capital are out there, because, and these are development deals, these are entitlement deals. This is not like this is cash flowing stabilized real estate. So, you know, situations like that, I think there's a message there.
Yeah, I would say for me, that's the biggest single difference between now and 10 years ago, right? That to your point, you know, the market is just awash with dry powder right now. We did an analysis last week on hotel losses thus far in the cycle. Of course, there haven't been too many of them, but, you know, the losses are a fraction of what they were in that 2009 to 2015 period. And so much of it is, you know, during that period 10 years ago, we just didn't see that wave of liquidity that you're seeing right now.
Well, the fact is, none of us have seen this amount of liquidity in my career, which is longer than a few of you. This is an anomaly. This is a fact pattern that is absolutely anomaly. And because of that, we are beginning to witness what I will call some chinks in the armor, where there's some underwriting standards are beginning to fall by the wayside, where the assumptions moving forward are that rents will always go up. You know, they're putting higher leverage, which these debt funds are able to do, on assets. The margins of the cash on cash return versus the exit cap rates, they're only like 150 basis points. You don't have to have a lot go wrong. Either the costs go up, construction takes a little longer, rates go up a little bit, and you're going to foot fault. And so you combine that with these amazing low cap rates, with the increase in construction costs, which leads to construction delays, mainly because of the supply chain. And these are issues that grownups should be paying attention to. But all of this is being solved on its surface because of the massive amount of liquidity. If I had 20 bucks for everybody that calls me, because they know that we see deals, and I'm like the canary in the coal mine, when things percolate to the surface, I could have retired long ago. I'm going to actually raise it to $30.
Doug, speaking of adults, are you telling me, wait, but don't rents just always go up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I call it when every time I've heard every cycle, this is a new paradigm, then I'm going for the exits.
Gonna this be is different a new this time.
It's different this time. Things will always go up. Well, you know, we'll stay tuned. That's why I started this business model a few years ago. And so we'll wait by the wayside. I have confidence in history.
Doug, I would just say kind of anecdotally on your concept there of people calling you up looking for deals. I mean, there have always been kind of brokers and agents and advisory firms and other things that help put capital to work. But we're seeing kind of on a monthly or weekly basis, new firms sprouting up that are literally just, hey, we'll go find you off-market opportunities to put your money to work. And it just goes to show you how much capital there is out there, that there are actually businesses sprouting up that'll just say, I'll just go search for stuff for you. And people are willing to pay for it because there's so little deal flow out there.
Well, I think if we all go back 18, 20 months ago, in anticipation of being this influx of deals, everybody, I think my FedEx delivery guy started a fund to pursue distressed assets. And they all called us. And now you have this massive amount of money on the sideline, all looking for distressed deals. And there aren't many of them because of all of the issues that we have that are converging together at this point in history.
I keep waiting for Joe to tell me the shoeshine boy has told him he's got a distressed asset tip that he wants to drop on.
Well, that's what happened to Joe Kennedy in 1929. That's when he sold.
Well, all right. Maybe we can all make a pact and say that if we ever run into the shoeshine boy that tells us this is the case, we'll share that with each other and know that it's time to get out.
It'll be our bond. I'll share it just between us.
That's right.
Doug, you mentioned that, you know, people are calling you looking for deals. So let's share a little bit of your insight with our listeners. You've got some unique insight into the different property sectors. Give us your thoughts about the health and the outlook of some of the key ones.
Okay, we'll go through this, and you cover this fairly frequently, but, you know, obviously multifamily fared better than anybody would have thought and continues to do so. There's a vast amount of money being thrown at that. You know, even with cost increases on the construction side and the like, everyone is underwriting to rental standards increasing. So, you know, that is probably the most active, intensified asset class. That and obviously industrial, for all the reasons that we all know about industrial, has been remarkably hot. Hospitality has been, you know, this great mixed bag. Part of that receivership we had was a hotel in Laguna Beach right there, you know, that was in the tank last winter. And then by April, it was just killing it. And so when you had these resort and all the leisure travel hotels, which were doing nothing, just rebounded very, very quickly. So they're actually doing well. Hotels generally are doing so much better, you know, but for obviously the larger, you know, group business convention hotels, that type of thing. Senior living, which I also have developed in the past, so I know personally, you know, has had serious challenges. And it's going to take a few years to really work through those challenges and to understand, you know, it's going to take a while for COVID to work its way through the system and they understand the impact. Long-term, people are still getting older. And so I think I am confident in the long-term, the longevity. You know, I think obviously office is the one that everyone talks about that's a big unknown today, which it is a big unknown. My ULI council recently, we had someone from JLL say that only 30% of offices are occupied. Forget what the vacancy is, but I'm talking about occupied people showing up in the office. And it can go from a low side in San Francisco to a high side in Dallas and somewhere in between. But, you know, you combine that and what's the longevity and what's the nature of the work look like and what's going to happen. I don't know, but it's certainly going to change. And there are clearly challenges. There are kind of secondary sectors that we are seeing, like in here in California, cannabis is a big deal, you know, and that's an industry that has a lot of longevity to it in these other markets. But because cannabis has issues with landlords and with lenders, and it's not federally regulated, we've seen a lot of activity on that front, by the way, which is interesting, because it can't be, they can't go through a federal regulatory remedy like a bankruptcy. They have to go through a receivership. So I guess there's a frothiness to all of this, in my belief. And so, you know, obviously multifamily is out of the woods, you know, and these rents are amazing.
Doug, so just something that came up recently, and we've been reading and kind of watching it, but not really totally able to connect all the dots, and maybe you can. I mean, are you seeing fallout from China, Evergrande, you know, these big real estate companies that have kind of webs of ownership of and investments in the U.S. kind of, I don't know, is there kind of any ripple effects that you're seeing there?
Well, I personally find it very troubling. And I think those are a very obvious storm clouds on the horizon that we should be paying serious attention to. They've got a systemic problem in their system, as evidenced by the amount of units that have been built that are unoccupied, the amount of capital that's out there in these bonds and the exposure. That could be a systemic blow, not just to China, but other marketplaces. We see that evidence in other projects here, you know, in California. We have one up in LA and another one in San Francisco with the same lender that both stopped construction a couple of years ago. You know, these are billion-dollar projects with skeletal towers built up to 40, 50 stories that aren't completed and are just fraught with, you know, liens and litigation and judgments and the like. And, you know, you can't look at something like that and saying, that's not a problem. You know, what I've observed in my career is that oftentimes it's some black swan event. It's some anomaly. It's some unique thing that can happen. And we are, as much as some people want to say we're nationalists, we're not. We're an interconnected global world. And so I do have high level of concern about a ripple effect. And I think that's something we've got to all have eyes wide open about.
So we've talked about a couple of things that have shown up, you know, on people's radar. Joe just brought up HNA and Chinese investment and so forth before. You talked about weakening underwriting standards and some froth. You know, what are some other things that maybe the national media has not captured yet, or the, you know, average real estate investor, that you think could be the next tipping point of concern? Rising interest rates, inflation, supply chain. You know, what are the things that, you know, people may think are apart from commercial real estate or not on their radar yet that may unsettle the market before this whole thing is said and done?
It's a combination of all of those factors happening simultaneously that is concerning. Combine that with the fact that people have very, very short memories, and people literally are out there saying that, you know, this time, even with all these signals on the horizon we've talked about, the supply chain, the construction costs, the lower interest rates, underwriting standards, the higher leverage, all of those things in combination with the potential of a black swan event, with issues like we're sitting here and I see 75 ships off the Southern California coast out of Long Beach. That's a problem. And that's not going to just go away immediately. And it impacts all of us in this industry. And so, you know, I think it is, again, I'm Irish. I'm inherently optimistic, and I'm a developer. But that having been said, I'm also a realist. And I just think that to think that things go on forever is naive at best and often does not end well. again, thank you for this opportunity today.
And just an FYI for anybody out there listening, if you want to reach out to Doug, feel free to shoot us an email at podcast@trep.com and we will put you in touch. Thanks again, Doug. This was great.
Two quick programming notes. Next week, we'll be hosting two separate webinar events, a CISA webinar on Tuesday and a global ESG community call on Thursday. If you're interested in either of those, reach out to us at podcast@trep.com and we'll send you links to those events. Thanks to our guest, Douglas Wilson, and thanks to our producer, Haley Keene. Join us next week for our normal week in review as we look at what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. For more information, visit trep.com and subscribe to the podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening and stay well.
All right.